Thanks for joining me for part 5 of our study of Mystery Babylon, a verse-by-verse look at Revelation 17 and 18. You can get the previous studies in text, audio, or video at the website versebyversebibleteaching.com. So we will pick up right where we left off last time in Revelation 17, verse 12. It says, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast." Let's first go back and read up to this point so we can refresh our memories and get the context for this current passage. The angel in the section we studied last time had been giving the interpretation of John's vision of the beast that the woman is riding. We know from Revelation 13, as well as other verses in this chapter, that the beast she is riding is the Antichrist. So the verses leading up to our current verse say, "This calls for a mind of wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction." We talked about the description of the Antichrist here, which has 7 heads. John says that the 7 heads are 7 kings. In the last study, we talked about why it's more likely that John means what he says here, that is, that these heads are different kings and not kingdoms, as some suppose. So we talked about how 5 times the spirit of Antichrist has manifested itself in the form of kings in John's past. 1 king currently was living at the time, and 1 future manifestation of the Antichrist was yet to come. This is the one that we believe will have the mortal wound and yet live, the one that we call the Antichrist. I want to briefly mention, speaking on this topic of the resurrection of the Antichrist, many people asked me in part 3's study if I believed that Satan has the power to raise people from the dead. And I originally included in part 3 a lengthy discussion about that topic, but I ultimately excluded it because I thought it was too much of a rabbit trail. But to answer the question, no, I do not believe that Satan has the power to raise the Antichrist or anybody else from the dead. However, I do believe that the Antichrist really does raise from the dead. I think when you put all those verses together, he actually is raising from the dead. So how do you answer that paradox? For more on that question, I will put together an appendix audio on that very question, and you can find that in the notes. There is also a scholarly article on this point called "Can Satan Raise the Dead? Toward a Biblical View of the Beast's Wound" by Gregory H. Harris. He's a professor of Bible exposition, and I recommend that paper if you're interested. And I agree with the overall premise of that paper, but I would probably disagree on some of the finer points about the false prophet and some other issues that he's got going on there. Okay then, back to our verse in Revelation 17:12, which says, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast." So, in our verse, we see that the beast has 7 heads, but also 10 horns. We are not told exactly how these horns are distributed on the 7 heads, or if they are even on the 7 heads at all. We don't know if 6 of the heads have 1 horn, and the 7th has 4 horns, or if they have some other arrangement. I think that when we consider the following passages, we will find that these 10 horns have a job working with the final head. So if I were to make a guess, these horns are either all on one head, the 7th and final head, or not on the heads at all, but on some other part of the body. I also say that because the 4th beast of Daniel 7, verses 7 through 8, also has 10 horns all on one head, that beast is widely considered to be associated with the Antichrist in Daniel 7. So let's consider the symbolism so we can get our bearings in this difficult passage. The 7 heads of this beast are 7 kings. And now we are told that the horns of this beast are also kings. So what's this talking about? Let's read ahead so we can get the context and find the relationship of these kings to the Antichrist according to the angel. And this will help us make an informed decision about this text. Revelation 17:12 through 17 says the following, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings for 1 hour with the beast. These have 1 mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he saith unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the horse sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. So it seems what we have here is one super king, a supreme dictator, which is the final yet future head of the Antichrist beast, that has 10 other kings under his total authority. So part of the point of this symbol of the horns on the beast is speaking of a consolidation of power of some kind. The purpose for this consolidation is very interesting, and we will talk about that when we get to those verses. But the symbolism here of the 10 horns on the beast is one main ruler ruling over other kings, which willingly give their authority to this dictator, who then uses them to do his bidding. But before we move on, I would like to briefly talk about the book of Daniel. I take a slightly different view on the beasts of Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 than some. I think it's a possibility that all 4 of the beasts of Daniel 7 may be contemporary with the Antichrist. I think that if this is true, there is much more detail that we can know about the end time scenario than has previously been considered. I'm still trying to figure this out for myself, and so I will leave it for your study. But I will direct you to a 4-part paper called Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, Equal or Not Equal, by Charles Cooper, former professor of hermeneutics at Moody. Okay, the next section of this verse says, Which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. First of all, please notice that this is making a distinction between kings and kingdoms here quite boldly. It says 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet. This is a strong rebuke to those that continually try to make the references to kings in these chapters mean kingdoms because of their various presuppositions. But John here demonstrates that if he, or the angel who he is recording, wants to say kingdoms instead of kings, they are quite willing and capable of doing so. So these kings in our verse are directly tied to the beast. It says that they only rule for, quote, 1 hour with the beast. We'll talk more in detail about their kingdoms and how they give away their power to the beast as we look at the next 2 verses, where we will get more detail about this. So let's take those 2 verses together. Revelation 17, 13, and 14 says, These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So we see one of the reasons these kings are given power. That is, to war against the Lamb, who is of course Jesus Christ. This battle is referring to Armageddon. This may help explain the idea of these kings ruling for only 1 hour. By the Battle of Armageddon, things are looking pretty grim for the Antichrist. This would be the final attempt at preventing the return of Christ to take his throne. But to understand as much as we can about these kings, we need to hop over to Revelation 16 when it's talking about the 6th bowl of wrath being poured out. The 6th bowl is talking about the Battle of Armageddon. This is where we will see more about these 10 kings and their warring with the Lamb. So, Revelation 16, 12 through 16 says the following. And the 6th angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw 3 unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. So these kings are gathered together by miracle-working demonic spirits sent forth in this bizarre ritual of the unholy trinity of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. And these demonic spirits are presumably what causes them to agree to the suicide mission of trying to war against the living Christ, which, in case you're wondering, does not turn out too good for them. The next section says, "And shall give their power and strength." Now, I'm not entirely sure that these kings ever do get kingdoms or not, but they have some kind of assets that are utilized by the beast. And it says here that they give their power and strength to the beast for this mission of warring against the Lamb. RevelationCommentary.org notes, "The title Lord of Lords and King of Kings is applied to the Lamb here and the rider on the white horse in Revelation 19:16. Revelation 19 is another picture of the Battle of Armageddon. Revelation 19:15 through 16 says, "Speaking of the descent of the Lamb, and out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." So we see here a clear reference to Armageddon again. And as we compare the different scriptures about these kings and the final battle that they are drawn to fight, my hope is that we are getting a better understanding of who these kings are. Let's go down a rabbit trail for a minute, because you may be asking the question, how is Armageddon referenced all these times in all these different places, like Revelation 16, 17, and 19, if the book of Revelation is chronological? Well, let me assure you that not everyone sees the book of Revelation as chronological, but I think it's because they don't see the simple structure of this great book. It helped me tremendously to see the structure of the last few chapters of Revelation, so I'll take a moment to explain it with this graph I made. On the left, you'll see the seven bowls, and they're detailed in chapter 16. These include the worst parts of God's judgment in the book of Revelation, and I believe they occur relatively quickly and close together. The sixth bowl details the Battle of Armageddon. This is where we saw the spirits like frogs which gather the kings to the Battle of Armageddon. And the seventh bowl details the judgment of the horror of Babylon and the earthquake that surrounds that event. The next few chapters are what I like to call zoom chapters, where the step-by-step chronology is halted in order to give more specific details about someone or something. In the case of the next two chapters, 17 and 18, it gives the finer details of the seventh bowl, which is where Mystery Babylon is destroyed. The next chapter, chapter 19, mostly details the sixth bowl in finer detail. This is where we just read that it says, "On his thigh was a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." When Revelation 19 is done zooming in on the finer details of the sixth bowl, or Armageddon, it picks right back up in Revelation 20, where the timeline left off in Revelation 16. Then in Revelation 20, we see the Antichrist and the false prophet judged, right where you would expect it to be if it was a continuation from Revelation 16. Then the completion of the first resurrection happens, the thousand-year peace, or the millennium, begins. Then it continues and describes the time after the thousand-year period, when Satan is released to gather the nations for one final battle, the Gog-Magog War. And finally, we see the very last event in the chronology of all prophetic revelation, the New Jerusalem and the Eternal Kingdom descending. I hope this gives you a better understanding of the chapters that we're studying, and I think you'll find it's easier to understand this book when you plug in the concept of zoom chapters to the book of Revelation. Okay, back in our study, the next verse is Revelation 17, verse 15. It says, "And he saith unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the horse sitteth, are peoples, multitudes, and nations, and tongues." So first this phrase, "the waters which thou sawest." The angel here is giving the interpretation of the waters that he saw the whore on. The waters are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. This idea of sitting on peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues is a way to say that the city of Mystery Babylon rules over many and has great power and authority. This is consistent with the later descriptions of Mystery Babylon's actions in the next chapter and her relationship to the other kings of the earth and the other nations. This same language is used when Jeremiah talks about the destruction of actual Babylon in Jeremiah 51:13. It says, "O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures, thine end has come, and the measure of thy covetousness." You'll see many similar things like this in Jeremiah 51. I think that this is why Mystery Babylon is called Mystery Babylon, because Mystery Babylon in Revelation 17 shares not only the city of Babylon's former power over nations, but also shares her worship of the false gods, as well as ultimately Babylon's pattern of judgment detailed in Jeremiah 51. We have, of course, been detailing in our study the possibility of the eschatological city of Jerusalem being Mystery Babylon, the city that rules many nations in the time of Antichrist. It should be noted that the Jews and Christians both believe that Jerusalem will be the capital city of the world in the Messianic Age. The book of Zechariah is just one of many places in the Bible where this promise is made. Zechariah 12:3-4, 16-17 says, "Then shall the Lord go forth, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." You will find glimpses of Jerusalem's future as world capital are sprinkled all throughout the Psalms and the major and minor prophets. Jewish people have been waiting for thousands of years for someone to make Jerusalem the world capital, just as their scriptures promise that it will be. I think that our verse in Revelation 17:15 and others like it show that the Antichrist will succeed in doing this to an extent, as he masquerades as their Messiah. He will make Jerusalem the uncontested world capital. If you understand this, the entire next chapter about the people making pilgrimages and bringing tribute to Mystery Babylon as if it was the city of the Messianic Age and as if the Antichrist was the Messiah, then it will make a lot more sense to you, I think. People will try to use this verse about her sitting on waters, which are nations, to say that the seven-headed beast which she sits on represents kingdoms, not kings. They would say that this verse defines the beast itself, as opposed to the waters that both the woman and the beast sit on. To say it another way, they're saying that the waters here are the beast, as opposed to what the beast along with the woman atop him are sitting on. They would say that, well, it says that she sits on waters here, and it says in another place that she sits on the beast, so the beast and the waters must be the same. But I think it's wrong for at least two reasons. One is that it's more logical to assume that she, the Mystery Babylon city, is sitting on a seven-headed beast, and both of them are sitting on the waters, that is, ruling over the peoples, nations, etc. In other words, the city of Jerusalem, the woman, and the beast that she rides, the Antichrist, are both sitting, or ruling, many peoples and nations. It's the Antichrist and his capital city, ruling over the rest of the nations. Not only is this consistent with what we just looked at about the ten horned kings who give their authority to the beast, but it also connects to Revelation 13, where we see that the seven-headed, ten-horned Antichrist beast comes out of the sea, which is a consistent idiom for peoples and nations. He is not the sea itself in Revelation 13. In fact, that chapter makes it very clear, in my opinion, that he is in fact a human king. All right, our next verse is Revelation 17, verse 16. It says, "And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire." This is a very interesting development. The ten kings, who we saw earlier, are subordinate to the Antichrist and are used to go to war against God, are also used here to destroy the city of Mystery Babylon. So, the Antichrist here turns on the woman. We will see later that although the kings who do this are under the complete control of the Antichrist, it is God, ultimately, that causes this to happen for the purposes of his judgment. Interestingly, this verse is the fulfillment of a detailed prophecy in the Old Testament book of Ezekiel about Jerusalem. So, let's take a look. It starts out saying, "And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations." So you can see from verse 1 and 2 that the following prophecy is about Jerusalem. The context in this chapter also makes this very clear. So keeping in mind our current verse in Revelation 17 about the ten kings hating the whore, making her desolate and naked, and burning her with fire, and let's read Ezekiel 16:38-41 to see what I believe is an exact fulfillment of this prophecy. It says, "And I will judge you as a woman who break wedlock or shed blood are judged. I will bring blood upon you in fury and jealousy. I will also give you into their hand, and they shall throw down your shrines and break down your high places. They shall also strip you of your clothes, take your beautiful jewelry, and leave you naked and bare. They shall also bring up an assembly against you, and they shall stone you with stones and thrust you through with their swords. They shall burn your houses with fire and execute judgments on you in the sight of many women. And I will make you cease playing the harlot, and you shall no longer hire lovers." This is exactly fulfilled in our verse back in Revelation 17:15. Some people would say that all this has been fulfilled in 70 AD or with Babylon, and I have many problems with that, not just the issues of the fire and different historical aspects, but primarily because when God speaks of these judgments, it speaks of when it is done, it's done. They will no longer play the harlot. They will no longer worship false gods. And we simply can't say that of any of the past judgments of Israel. And when you plug in all the other future, very obviously eschatological prophecies of judgment, things that simply have not happened yet, we must conclude that there is a future judgment of Israel, and it's always followed by this idea of total reconciliation. So we must see these as eschatological if we are to be straightforward with the text, in my opinion. Okay, back to these kings who destroy Mystery Babylon. It should be noted that these earthly kings only constitute a small portion of her destruction. She is also judged by earthquakes and fire from heaven, as well as whatever these kings do. I would also submit that the ultimate judgment of Mystery Babylon and the Battle of Armageddon probably take place very close to one another. I also think that they will happen at very near the same place, i.e. Jerusalem. For more on this possibility, see a paper called A Big Problem, Where is Armageddon? An Examination of Revelation 16:16. And I'll put that in the notes. Very interesting paper that proposes that the correct word there is Har-Moed, and has a very good argumentation to demonstrate that. But I will leave that for your study. But for now, all you need to know is that although the Antichrist turns on the city of Mystery Babylon and uses these lackey kings to plunder her, it is by no means the only judgment that she receives according to the seventh bowl judgment and parallel passages. So the next verse, Revelation 17:17, says, "For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled." So this first part, "For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will," this shows the sovereignty of God in all this, that God is the ultimate force behind this judgment, whether these kings know it or not. And it's made even more clear in the next chapter, which says in Revelation 18:8, "Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judgeth her." The next part says, "And to agree and give their kingdoms unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled." Again, this harkens back to the fact that these 10 kings give their power and authority to the beast. Here it says that they collectively have a kingdom, which is interesting because it's not a plural kingdoms as you would expect. I think this is interesting because it may indicate that these 10 kings are representatives of one collective kingdom. This may also explain why they didn't have a kingdom, quote, yet in verse 12, and why they were only said to give power and authority in verse 13. But that's not entirely clear to my thinking right now, and I wouldn't make too much out of that, but it is interesting. The next verse, Revelation 17:18, the final verse of Revelation 17, says, "And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth." Now we know from the passages we read today that Mystery Babylon will sit over many nations and peoples and tongues, and will be the city that the Antichrist rules from. But I think the problem that many commentators have here is that they try to look around their current days and find which city rules over the earth in their day. This tendency to look to our surroundings for the fulfillment of this passage, as opposed to the future, has caused a lot of bad interpretations here, in my opinion. Considering the Antichrist is supposed to set up a world government that most of us would agree is in the future, why would we feel the need to have the passages about his world government capital city fulfilled in the past? The temptation has been too great to resist for most commentators in my library, anyway. Moving on to this idea of the phrase great city, I'm under the impression that the Bible would not like us to speculate on this point about the identity of Mystery Babylon. And one of the many ways it is given us to answer the question about the identity of Mystery Babylon is by the use of this term, great city. The phrase great city is used 10 times in the book of Revelation, and every time it refers to the city of Jerusalem. Many people would violently disagree with me on that point because they don't see Mystery Babylon, which is called the great city many of those times, as Jerusalem. So let's set aside for the time being the instances of the phrase great city in Revelation used to refer to Mystery Babylon, and let's only talk about the references to the great city where it is absolutely undisputed that it's talking about Jerusalem. For example, in Revelation 11, verse 8, it says, "And their dead bodies," now this is speaking of the two witnesses who are killed by the Antichrist. So it says, "And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified." Obviously, the city where Jesus was crucified is Jerusalem. Nobody would deny that. Some commentators concede this point begrudgingly, knowing the problem that it creates later on. I would also call your attention to the definite article ho in the Greek here, as in the great city. This ensures that we know that Jerusalem is considered by John to have the title of the great city. But these great city references show that Mystery Babylon is Jerusalem in another way as well. Revelation 16:19 distinguishes the great city from the cities of the nations. Revelationcommentary.org states, "This is the second proof that the great city refers to Jerusalem. The cities of the nations, Gentiles, is in contrast to the great city, Jews." So understand this part. The word Gentiles and nations are almost synonymous. They're interchangeable. There are two types of cities in the world, if you want to look at it from a Jewish perspective: Jerusalem and the Gentile cities. And this verse, Mystery Babylon, is contrasted with the cities of the nations, which suggests that it is not a Gentile nation. Some scholars that recognize the significance of Revelation 16:19 will try to make the reference to Babylon here be a third entity in the discussion. The word "and" here in the King James seems to lend credibility to this third-party interpretation. In other words, they will say that the great city, which they would concede is Jerusalem, is split into three parts, and the cities of the nations also fell, and Babylon was mentioned as the third party. Most would say that only two parties are in view here: the great city divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations. The following mention of the great Babylon is in reference to the great city mentioned just before. Other translations agree, especially the newer ones. They connect the great city in the first part to great Babylon. The Net Bible says the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. So Babylon the Great was remembered before God and was given the cup filled with the wine made of God's furious wrath. In the footnote, the Net Bible explains why it rendered Chi as so. It says to indicate the implied result of Babylon's misdeeds, see Revelation 14:8. Another new Bible translation, expected to be completed later on this year, the ISV, says, "The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. God remembered to give Babylon the Great the cup of wine filled with fury of his wrath." The Net Bible renders this "so Babylon." The ISV renders it "God remembered to give Babylon." That is to say that it did not introduce a new character here, but gave more information about the first character mentioned. And this would make an unambiguous case that the great city is definitely Mystery Babylon, and it's definitely Jerusalem. I know that this was a long way around, but the simple version is that the last verse of Revelation 17 calls Mystery Babylon the great city, a term that is also used very directly to identify the Jerusalem of the Antichrist, by the same author, in the same book, using a definite article to indicate a title, or at least a very definite identification with the phrase. This concludes Revelation chapter 17 and today's study. We will pick up where we left off next week in Revelation 18, verse 1. I will put in the notes of this presentation the links to the articles I mentioned and the appendix audio I did about the Antichrist. You will find the whole Mystery Babylon study in video, audio, or text at versebyversebibleteaching.com.